You tuned into Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hey everybody, it's Nikki Nellis, Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. It just so happens that I am I'm beastless again. This is sort of a trend, which I kind of like because I really think I should be doing the show without him anyway. So here I am doing the show without him, although this should really be a show with him because I am talking to some of the biggest beer aficionados in the city. We're going to be talking about beer history and home brewing. And I also have in studio with me Sarah Jane Curran, who does Brew Me, which every time I say the radio show,
Beer Me.
Every time I say it, I want to say Do Me because of that song, like Do Me Baby. I assume that's where you got it from, right?
No, I got it from the phrase Beer Me Bra.
Oh.
Like as one frat man would say to another.
Oh, okay. But sorry, just, I wasn't in a frat.
There are
so
just no,
I missed that one.
It's, you know, Beer Me, but, you know, no bros involved.
No bros involved. So let's talk a little bit about your show. It's on Full Service Radio. It's mm-hmm. on Mondays at 11. And talk about the kinds of things you're doing. I popped in today. You had an incredible crew of people. Let's hear about it.
Yeah, this Monday we were incredibly spoiled. We had peeps Mari and Brendan from DC Brow, and then we also had Chef Mikey Freeman on from Red Hen and All Purpose. Mm-hmm. So the whole point of the show is that I wanted to look at the beer industry from different facets. So I didn't mm-hmm. want it to be brewer, brewer, brewer. I didn't want it to be let's taste this beer and talk about it while nobody can see really what we're doing. Mm-hmm. I wanted to kind of see the industry from different eyes. So I've had distributors, I've had importers, educators, bartenders, just so that every week it's kind of a different view.
But what about you? I mean, what's your background in beer?
I started to enjoy good beer when I was at the Culinary Institute of America, mm-hmm. kept that overpriced education going at NYU, where I focused on beer culture and history. I was the beer director at 11 Madison Park and the beer bar general manager.
Now I just feel like you're dropping names. Never mind. I'm sorry I asked. No, I'm just
joking. So yeah. And then I was here at Bertram Bailey Church Key for 2 years as the general manager. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I, you know, I'm not the most knowledgeable person in the entire world.
But nobody
beer.
Is.
So that's the beauty of it. It's this really great community, and every single person I've encountered in this industry has been really sweet and really welcoming. So it's a fun thing to kind of keep exploring every week with all the listeners.
What's one of your favorite shows that you've done so far? Who's been your, like, one of your favorites? I know it's like picking children, but you know what I mean.
You know what? I got to say, my very first show was with Katie Marisick from the Brewers Association. Mm-hmm. And I was so nervous and I was so inexperienced because I have no, you know, media background or anything like that. I come from restaurants. And she really put me at ease. And it was like a nice show. It kind of felt like I was sitting there talking shop with somebody. So that show will always be... You know, don't go listen to it because I sounded like a goober, but
that
you know.
Is absolutely no. You have a really incredible soothing radio presence.
Thank
it's
you.
It's very, very nice.
I'm
and
in the
your
market
shows are great.
For being hired to read books.
I think you should be. Books on tape. Here you come. And what are some of the guests that you have booked coming up?
So we have some exciting shows coming up. I know we've got Fairwinds. On the books, they're a local brewery that I really enjoy. Let's see, I'm so sorry. I know that the guys from Silver Branch Brewing Company, they mm-hmm. are not quite open yet, but they will be open in Silver Spring. Mm-hmm. So they'll be coming on prior to their opening. I know the Homebrewers Association and Katie Marisick are coming back on to talk about some competitions that they have coming up. And definitely I've got another kind of beer and food pairing show with Chef Kyle Bailey from the Salt Line.
Oh, fabulous.
Yes.
All right, good. Well, hopefully you'll come back in studio
yeah.
just to keep us posted on what you're doing on your show.
Of course.
Beer Me.
Yeah.
Not Brew Me, Nick. And you know, keep us posted on what you're doing. Tell people where they can find you on Instagram, please.
At Beer Me Radio.
Okay, excellent. Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us.
Okay, so today's guests, some have been on Full Service Radio before. Everybody here, Full Service Radio? No, we have one newbie. Okay, we got a virgin over there. Great. So I have Michael Stein and Peter Jones, and they are both beer historians and educators with Lost Lagers. And also, Sarah, I didn't ask how to correctly pronounce your name before the show, and now I am regretting it terribly. Please say your last name.
Bondioli.
Okay, I would have never said that right, so thank you. And she's the president of the DC Homebrewers Club. So I want to thank you all for joining us today. We were talking off air about the history of beer, and especially craft and local beer, and how it relates to home brewers and what's going on, especially in DC. And I had said to you that I felt like it was like coffee. Like, there's multiple waves, and you know, they talk about the third wave and fourth wave. What wave are we in with beer today in the DC market?
Great question. So I think before the show, you characterized it as the third wave, which I would totally co-sign.
Okay.
It is the third wave.
Okay.
Let's say roughly 1969. The first wave, we're talking about Anchor Steam beer.
Mm-hmm.
The second wave, about 1984, when Sierra Nevada and Boston Beer Company come online. It's at two opposite ends of the country, Sierra Nevada and Chico, California, Boston Beer in Boston. And then the third wave, which would be today. So all spread out, you know, between 20 and 30 years apart.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, brewing is ancient. And we know that the earliest brewers in human history were women. And you've had...
Because it wasn't like something they just did at home. It was a part of...
Certainly sometimes...
Daily chores?
Yep, sometimes it's a domestic task, but the earliest written record we have of beer is called the Hymn to Ninkasi. And Ninkasi was a Mesopotamian goddess of beer, goddess mm-hmm. of the flowing waters. She's kind of a demigod, you know, the way we think of kind of like half human, half god. But mm-hmm. The earliest hymn to her is not just a hymn in the sort of modern sense of, let's say, a hymn, but a recipe as well for beer.
Really?
Yeah.
Fascinating. But beer has always been a part of communities, people's lives, and it's a part, you know, as historians, how far back do you guys go when you're doing your research?
So you know, as Mike mentioned, it can go back as far as Ninkasi's hymn. I would say we really focus on recipes that are written down. So, you know, you can have recipes that you can find evidence in the archaeological record. Mm-hmm. I'd say we focus more on kind of the more modern, you know, recipes that are in cookbooks or in kind of the archives somewhere in the dusty archives.
Well, let's back up a little bit. Why don't we tell people a little bit more about Lost Lagers and what it is and what you guys really do?
Yeah. So Lost Lagers is the premier beverage research firm in Washington, D.C. I am president, Pete is CEO, and together we recreate old beers. So we brought a bunch of beers here to the studio. Pete brought a 1749 Rosemary Ale from Eliza Smith's The Complete Housewife, which is technically, some food historians would argue, the first cookbook in American history.
Okay.
After that, I have an 1812 beer. The 1812 Project is something I brewed with Blue Jacket way back when they were bottling. So it's about 4 years old. And then I also have a 1934 Pale Ale. So this was right after FDR made good on the repeal of Prohibition. So
okay.
This is about a 4% beer, as strong as it could be in 1934. And that's generally our comfort zone from 18th century. Yep, and then Pete also brought historic
and all of a sudden,
porter.
Another
not
bottle.
To be outdone, it just emerged.
Right.
from the Pendruid Brewing Company out in Sperryville, Virginia. Those are our friends who are sort of, you know, artisanal ale makers. Every batch is different. No batch is the same. I know from past episodes you've had, the owner of Cheesateak, and she's talked about artisanal products and how there's no problem with variance because you expect that from artisanal products comparatively to larger scale products where you want consistency batch to batch to batch.
Right. Well, so, but what made you guys decide as you entered the beer world that you're like, yeah, we're going to recreate these recipes? I mean, were people clamoring for it, or did it start out as something you wanted to do and you realized other people wanted it as well?
I think Mike and I both have a passion for history. And so it kind of grew from this idea of, you know, what did the early beers that people in DC, you know, in the pre-prohibition era, what did these beers taste like? And so we wanted to try and recreate what they were drinking back then. And that kind of led us to the archives and records at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History and try and recreate one of the biggest brewers in DC's history, Christian Heyrich.
Right.
So if you've heard of the Heyrich House.
Yeah. Sure.
We worked with them.
Yeah, so trying to recreate one of his Heyrich's lager.
Now, did were any of these, I mean, I know you call them extinct ales, but like at the Hyrek House, did they happen to have old bottles by chance or anything?
They didn't have records of recipes.
There was a fire, right? Yeah, there was a fire.
There was a fire. Yep, exactly. Okay. And so we suspect that a lot of processes and record keeping burned up. Was actually, I guess, like the library, the brewery's library. Mm-hmm. And when that fire occurred, it's my understanding that that was the third location. Because mm-hmm. Hyrek ran from the 1870s until 1950s. Mm-hmm. The man, Christian Hyrek himself, dies in 1945, but the brewery goes on until 1956. And that's a crazy run, 1870s to 1950s. I mean...
No, that is a really long run.
Yeah.
I feel that people think that all things are supposed to last forever. You know, like when a restaurant closes after, you know, 10 years, they're like, oh, what happened? It's like, nothing's supposed to last forever. Yeah. You know, sometimes people are done.
Right.
You know, and it's time to move on and try something new or, you know, close shop.
Yeah. And I think that's part of our work, too, that Pete and I do. There's a large brewer who will remain nameless who likes to think they have monopoly on all of the old beers, all the old brands and labels.
How come we're not naming them? Come on.
Well, you know, we like to play nice in the sandbox.
Okay. That's boring.
But the point is, if you go back far enough in American history, you can find all of these brands that have gone the way of the dinosaur. They're just waiting to be brewed again. Mm-hmm. Like, is there a Nellis ale or a Nellis lager?
I'm going to say absolutely not, just so you know. There really isn't.
History's mystery.
History, no, that one's not a mystery because it's my husband's last name, which came from, they were from Russia. They were Russian Jews, Nesnewich, and I'm pretty sure they weren't brewing beer.
I never know.
No, I'm pretty sure about that. They were not brewing beer, but that's okay.
Right.
I don't think anybody on either side of the family was brewing beer. But it doesn't mean, but my son, Sam Nellis, who is an AGM at Red Hen and All Purpose, he worked with Sarah Jane over at Church Key and Birch and Barley. And when he was 21, after he graduated from college and after we dropped a dime on his education at Ithaca, he was like, yeah, I really want to do what Greg Angert does. And I was like, yeah, dude, you and every other 21-year-old kid who likes beer. But he really took his passion seriously. So I who knows where he'll go with it. Yeah. Now he's into cocktails, but he's a part of the industry now.
Which, yeah, the future is unwritten. So
exactly.
Maybe, you know, maybe
who knows what's next. Yeah. Well, Sarah, I want to bring you in on this. The Home Brewers Association. Let's give an elevator speech about it.
So the DC Home Brewers Club is our local chapter mm-hmm. of the American Home Brewers Association. Mm-hmm. And we just celebrated our 10-year anniversary in January.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So exciting.
Yeah. So we started with, I wasn't actually part of the original group. I don't think any of us here were, right?
Just too late. Yeah.
Not quite. The original group, I think they had an email list of about 50 people from that first year. And then now our email list, it's about 1,000 people. Mm-hmm. Caveat is that we have a lot of people on there who no longer live in DC. given that it's a very transient place. Mm-hmm. But, we have meetings every month and we regularly have in the realm of 25 to 70 people at each meeting, just depending on.
And what happens at these meetings?
So our meetings are basically, we get together, hang out, and try each other's beer. It's the main part. It's pretty casual.
It's like a beer potluck.
Yeah. We also have some education. So Mike is actually one of our education co-chairs currently. Pete was in the past at 1.2. And so our education co-chairs will come up with different speakers or experiments or things like that we bring into some of those meetings to just add a little education into the meeting about different styles of beer, different types of yeast. Our last meeting, we had Mike Tonsmeyer, who is a local beer blogger. Now he also co-owns a brewery.
Okay.
So he was, he's actually part of actually one of the original members from our club, but he came and talked to the group a little bit about just getting started in brewing and also going pro.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Are most of the people who are home brewing, do they have stars in their eyes? Like, do they come in and like, dude, try this. This is so good. I mean, is everybody looking to go the full-blown route?
I think it varies a little bit. There are definitely some people who come in, think their beer is amazing, and sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't.
Right.
And there are definitely people who come in thinking like they want to do this professionally and, you know, quit their government job and go brew beer because mm-hmm. that sounds like a lot more fun. But we also have a lot of members who seem to just enjoy doing it as a hobby.
Okay.
A lot of us don't work in the industry at all outside of the hobby aspect of it. And, you know, and brew beer regularly, bring it to the meetings and just like hanging out, brew day, having a brew day, making whatever kind of beer they want to drink mm-hmm. and just having the control to make what they want and, you know, knowing that you made that.
Well, so what was your interest in it? When did you get interested in brewing your own beer?
So I actually started about 6 years ago, and we were talking about the history of beer actually relates to kind of my interest. So I was reading a book that included a section about the history of beer, talked about how it really used to be almost solely women who were doing the brewing. And now,
can I just interrupt you? I mean, I've been doing this. I've been interviewing people on for over 10 years, about 15 years. This is the very first time that I've heard that it was women who did most of the brewing. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like probably because most of the people I've talked to about beer have been men. But no, you know, I don't mean to offend you,
no,
but
true.
I'm dead serious.
That's part of our mission.
I mean,
yeah.
Teresa has been on my show twice, but you mentioned it earlier. It's the very first time that I heard that. So it's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, when I was reading this, I hadn't realized that.
Sure.
I had been into beer, drinking beer mm-hmm. and trying different beers. And when I was reading this chapter, it kind of ended with this like, you know, there are a few more women nowadays starting to brew professionally, but really like more women should be brewing. And I thought, oh, like I bake things like bread from scratch, things like that. And I thought mm-hmm. it might be kind of fun to try making beer from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just tried it. And like, I feel like when you make your first batch and it actually turns into beer, it's a pretty fun moment because you don't really have an expectation that it will work.
It's not like baking a cake or baking bread. Well, I mean, if your dough doesn't rise, right? You already
right.
know what's going to happen. But with beer, you really don't know until you got your finished
wait
product.
Until a few weeks.
Oh my,
yeah.
It worked.
It's alive.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, you know, even with wine, you know, they're tasting it all along to make
right.
sure it has the complexities and the profiles that they're looking for. You don't really do that when you're brewing
yeah, you
beer,
can,
right?
You can sample a little bit, but kind of once it's getting going, like you don't have a lot of control over, you know, if it's a bad tasting beer, it's not a whole lot of stuff that you can do to make it taste
better. You
can't
better. Save it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're screwed.
Well, when you're brewing beer at home, what do batch sizes look like? Can we just do a little like 101?
Sure. Yeah,
sure.
About brewing at home and what that's like?
Well, we actually were just discussing this before we came in here a little bit. So you can really do a wide range of different ways of brewing as well mm-hmm. as sizes. So I started out doing a 1 gallon batch starting from the grain itself,
mm-hmm.
Which is called all grain. 1 gallon gives you like about 6-7 bottles of beer in the end, so it's a very small amount.
Okay.
But it's also really manageable, and I was living in a small apartment in DC and I didn't know what I was doing anyway, so mm-hmm. I didn't want to spend a lot of money, so it's a cheap way to get started. A lot of people end up brewing or even start out brewing like 5 gallons.
That's
is a pretty average mm-hmm. batch.
Okay.
Yep.
And a lot of people start with extract, which is a little
yep,
different.
That's how I started too. So that's
what does that mean?
That's instead of going from the grain, somebody else has basically gone from the grain, and essentially you're brewing with kind of the malt syrup. So it's kind of one step.
Is it
easier.
Like using like Betty Crocker?
It's sort of
yeah, same concept.
So like buying the mix.
It's
yeah. so what you're
like
doing?
Exactly.
Okay.
It's kind of like buying the mix. But you know, for starting out, I think
mean,
it's
no
a great
judgment.
Way.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It still
yeah.
makes
great
beer.
Right. Exactly. Duncan Hines sometimes has a good kick.
Yeah, and it's sort of like, you know, you take like the mix, but you can kind of tweak it, you know, use your own hops to make a certain, you know, recipe. I'd say it's maybe more akin to like you've got a building block and you can kind of put it together, but it's just a kind of an easier building block to use than kind of starting with the all grain where it's kind of one step removed.
And yeah. for you, what was the jump between brewing at home and, you know, helping people brew? Like, how did that happen for you?
Just kind of, you know, working with Mike. He has a lot of
Did your passion, were you guys, did you just meet by chance? Did your passion bring you together? Like, how was it?
The DC Homebrewers Club. Yeah. And so I've my day job is I'm a full-time historian. Mm-hmm. And so I always have loved history, and kind of brewing was sort of a side thing. And after meeting Mike, I realized I can do both of these together and really kind of teach people about history through beer, which is also really exciting.
Yeah.
So I think
and there's a market for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is really actually more exciting.
Right.
You know, I don't know if 20 years there was the same sort of platforms that are available today. I mean, I was thinking about how you were talking about the growth of your list. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think, first of all, there's social media. I mean, there's so many ways to tell people what you're doing and how you're doing it. But there is, and this goes back to our third wave, not just in beer, but in artisanal products in general, there is such an interest in knowing where your food comes from, where your wine comes from, where your beer comes from. Local is obviously an overused marketing term, but does apply when it comes to beer, especially, I believe, because when people come to town, they want to know, what are the local beers? Mm-hmm. I mean, 20 years ago, it wasn't even a question. Maybe it was if you went to up northeast or, you know, out to California. Yeah, or maybe like Portland and Seattle. But it couldn't happen here. So I think you have this tremendous change that has happened, and you guys get to really be, you know, sort of help promote it even further.
And it's kind of interesting, you know, we think of craft beer as this style of, you know, really pushing the envelope on ingredients and different types of beer. And so what we're kind of doing is kind of going the opposite way. But it's so cool to get all these craft brewers psyched about brewing a recipe from 100 years ago. And it's just as exciting to sort of see how a brewer 100 years ago was sort of putting together a recipe that might blow their mind in some way. Like, wait, you use how much of this type of malt? Really? I would have never thought to do that. And then we brew it, and it usually turns out pretty well.
So, well, let's talk about that. I'm curious about this one here.
So that,
the first one.
Yeah. So that is
rosemary ale.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't feel like there's a lot of rosemary ales out there.
So that is actually, we were talking about women in brewing. That
right.
was from the very first cookbook that was published.
It sounds medicinal.
It was published in the United States. It was called The Complete Housewife by Eliza Smith, published originally in Britain in 1720-something, but in the United States in Williamsburg in 1742.
Okay.
And and so this was basically what every quote-unquote housewife should know as far as different food recipes, as well as lots of different wine recipes. And this was sort of like the best quality beer that you can make. So it's
And what was it in her beer? What was it that she was putting in there? And I'm just curious because I want to hear how it's changed.
I brought
to
the
today.
Recipe here if you want to hear the first. It's this long chunk of text, but I'll read the first couple of lines. So it's Eliza Smith's recipe. This publication, this version of The Complete Housewife was 1747, and it says to make strong beer. To a barrel of beer, take 9 bushels of malt and half a bushel of wheat just cracked in the mill and some of the flour sifted out of it. When your water is scalding hot, put it in your mashing vat. There, let it stand till you can see your face in it.
Okay, lots of really usable directions.
Right. So there's two recipes on there too. To make strong beer is the one Pete did.
I like this one. Take 10 gallons of ale and a large cock. This is great.
Right.
Yeah, to make cock ale.
This is like reading for children.
So we use that as a slide of like what we're going to use. We're going to make strong beer. We're not going to make cock ale because we can't chase a
You're
chicken around the yard.
The cock?
We're not experts in flaying birds. But that's right. That's the whole idea. And so we were talking a little bit about size. Like, you know, 5 gallons is the standard. I now brew a gallon at home just because it's healthier for
space.
You know, it's healthier for me to have a 6-pack than 5 gallons, which is like two cases. But this is a barrel. This is 31 gallons. So this was all in a day's
that's
work.
That's right.
You would make two kegs worth of beer.
And how long does 2 kegs fun. I mean, they didn't have the same sort of sanitation and packaging availability, obviously, in the 1700s.
Right.
They put it in a barrel, right?
They didn't have the germ theory we have. They didn't have the yeast and microbiology theory and practice that we have. Mm-hmm. But what do you think?
It's really good.
Yeah. Smells of rosemary?
It smells delicious. I mean, it's really rosemary, which I love personally.
Yeah.
It's a really fragrant beer. So it's not strong.
No,
4%?
It's probably actually about 5.
Okay.
Even though it's quote unquote their strong ale, that would have been strong for them because usually they're making beer that's around 3% kind of for everyday. That would be on the high end even for everyday drinking.
Well, because they were drinking beer in a totally different way.
Correct.
Right?
Exactly.
It wasn't about necessarily getting drunk.
No.
It was
calories
about
drinking all day.
Yeah. Hydration, yep. Exactly. Yep. Because who knew if your water was safe?
The stat is something like 1% alcohol by volume kills 99% of waterborne bacteria. So even if your beer, wine, liquor, you can't really call something that's 1% alcohol beer, wine, or liquor, but let's say you did, it would ward off 99% of waterborne
illnesses. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. And at what point historically did that start? When did the alcohol start to creep up? Was it after water sanitation was in play? Like, did it all kind of combine together?
Yeah, so it did come together. You know, it helped that first the thermometer was discovered, and then after the thermometer came the hydrometer, and the hydrometer tells you how heavy the solution is comparatively to water, like hydro water.
Mm-hmm.
So if water is 1.000, this barley wine is 1.111,
okay.
Right? Or this table beer is 1.030.
Mm-hmm. So how much sugar is in there?
And
then
suspension.
You know how much alcohol is in there by how much the yeast has eaten, how much sugar the yeast has eaten.
Yep.
But what I guess my question is once they were able to, once they had the tools to start figuring that out, what was the priorities? Did they want to add more alcohol?
Was it a conscious decision?
Right.
It depended on the market. So Guinness is a great example because this is a 1747 recipe. Guinness had been operating for like 2 decades at this point in time, right?
Right.
So they had Guinness draft for the home market.
And so Guinness, I mean, to me, Guinness is like a piece of meat. Like, it's such a heavy beer.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then, so that one is about 4% alcohol.
Okay.
Guinness foreign export stout, export for the American colonies.
Sure.
Going, you know, south to London, going all over the world, was 7.5% alcohol. And it still is 7.5% today. So actually, you know, this goes back even to, like, times of Vikings and the Rus and the Boy and all these ancient tribes. They would make stronger beer for export.
So like, it lasts
because
on the
it
voyage.
Would last longer.
Yes.
Sure, that makes sense.
Precisely.
Okay,
precisely.
And then let's move forward a little bit before we take a break. Let's move forward a little bit to, like, I don't know, sort of industrialization and sort of factories and beers being made in a totally different fashion.
And that's actually the shift from the predominantly female brewers to the male brewers.
Of course,
because the capitalists, the scratch, Sarah's giving a scratch sign. Yep, they can make money. So, all right, let's take this out of the home. Let's bring it into the factory. Let's make some money.
Sure. Well, it's actually not dissimilar from the history of women in kitchens and chefs.
Mm-hmm.
It was predominantly a women field. It was usually women who did all the cooking. And when men came back from World War I, L'Escoffier created, you know, it was supposed to be like the bridge. That's why, you know, everybody's got their coats. Those are military-based coats. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to militarize and masculinize the kitchen so that females would feel unwanted in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really fascinating history because that's why females got out of the kitchen because they were kicked out.
And it's like, damn it, what a shame. Oh, but that gave us Julia Child.
Right? No, listen. At the end of the day, I mean, all things, there's pendulum swings in all industries and all businesses and in history, and we can all watch them happen. Yeah. But it is interesting to see it. All right, we'll take a quick break. When we get back, I think I have lots of beer to taste in my future from all years. It looks like we're going all over the centuries.
Yeah.
This is Nikki Nellis. I am Beastless on Industry Night and Full Service Radio in the Line Hotel. We'll be back in just a sec. It's Nikki Nellis, Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. We are talking with beer historians and educators of Lost Lagers, Michael Stein and Peter Jones. And Sarah, I'm getting nervous when I look at your name because I don't want to mispronounce it.
Bondioli.
Bondioli. I was going to say Bondioli and then it would have been wrong. She is with the DC Homebrewers Club. And you were telling me off air because you're the first female president. Yes?
Yes.
Which is really exciting. But you sort of got a hat trick going on there.
Yeah. So currently I'm the president and our vice president is Jeannie Burns. And then our treasurer secretary is Madeline Marshall. So right now we have three women at the top, which is really great because we haven't had that before.
It is really great. And are you finding that you're getting more women members?
I think we are. We don't have like a very technical way of like counting it.
Right.
But so for example, when I joined the club about 6 years ago, the first meeting I went to, I didn't know anyone. I just like walked in and I think the whole night there were maybe five women there total. Many of them were, you know, were there with their significant others, which is great too. But weren't necessarily like the main brewers in that relationship.
Okay.
But we did about 4 years ago started a women's kind of subgroup for the club.
Okay.
So it's called HOPS, which stands for Homebrew Outreach and Participation Sisterhood. And that is kind of, it's a subgroup that we focus on encouraging women to try brewing.
Okay.
So we try to do some like happy hours. We've done some speaker events and we also try to do some just brew days with women to encourage women who might want to see how it all works and might be a little intimidated in other settings to be able to come in and learn about it.
That's amazing. What a great idea. Plus, there are some women brewers in the area. I mean, you have Denizens.
Yes.
They do great stuff. Yeah. And I think there's more popping up in and around D.C. I mean, you guys would know more nationally than I do, but...
Yeah, there's, and even before Denizens, for many years, Christy Matthews Greiner, was at Cap City.
Okay.
She was the head brewer there for...
I always forget about Cap City.
...many years.
Yeah. Always forget about Cap City.
She was a great, she's done some speaking, she's come and spoken with our group before. She's a very great advocate for women in the industry.
Is she still in it?
Not she's like, I think she's still, she's bartending now, I believe. She kind of veered back out of the brewing, back to bartending.
Since we're myth busting, you can make way more money as a bartender than you can as,
as a brewer.
Yeah. I'll just leave it at that. But shout out to Christy. She's fantastic.
Okay. No, I totally get that. But that's very exciting that you're able to do that. And what about you guys as far as beer history, as we got into industrialization and men took over, how did the beer change? How did production change the kind of beer that people were drinking?
You know, we talked a little bit about the different instruments, and so they could really kind of turn it into more of a science, that, whereas kind of before, you know, they didn't understand why the beer was being brewed. That it just was sort of like the magical, you know, they'd touch it with the magic stick and then all of a sudden it would turn into beer, you know, 6 weeks later. Now they could understand a little bit better how it worked and control it better. And so the beer became probably less weird, more reproducible. And it did increase in strength, as you're talking about. You know, became more of what we think of as in the 5, 6%, 7% range. And it became much more regular, and we kind of started developing, I guess you would call it styles at that point, sort of an early version of styles. Like one of the first ones was probably porter in England, really became its own unique style in the 18th and 19th century.
Well, wait, you know, you said Guinness was from the
1720s.
And what were they calling it? They weren't calling it beer?
They were calling it porter at first, and then it changed to stout, I think like a decade or so.
Later?
Yeah.
Okay.
But that's actually a good example. So so working backwards, pasteurization preserves beer, but before we even knew about pasteurization from Louis Pasteur, famous chemist, we knew... the royal we, the ancestors who made beer, knew that hops preserve beer. And that really comes into play with the first written record of hops, I think is the 10th century, so 900 wow. AD. So we're talking, you know, not long after the Iron Age. Mm-hmm. And then even before that, strength. We knew that malt gave you a lot of strength and strong beers could travel well, okay. going way back in time. But yeah, so it's helpful to pick.
So what is the difference between, I just want to go back to Guinness for a second. Like, let's talk about the differences in the styles of beer for people who sure. are a little yeah. beer inept.
And porter yeah. and stout's a great one.
Yeah, so yeah. what are the differences between the two?
So back then, stout was less about a style and more about a description on the beer's strength. So okay. like, this is a stout beer, this is a strong beer.
Also an adjective for a person. I am stouter than Pete because he eats less calories than I do.
Okay.
Or in his daily intake. Right?
So, and so porter was more the description of the beer. But eventually, we kind of associated the stronger porters, these stronger stouter porters, as kind of their own thing. Like, oh, that's just a stout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the myth goes porter for the people who were the laboring class that were pulling the luggage off the Thames, the porters down at the docks
okay.
who were taking the cargo from the ships. They needed a fortifying, healthy beverage that kept them feeling robust all day long, thus robust
filled
porter
with calories,
was born.
Right?
Filled with calories,
mm-hmm.
right. So that's kind of the myth. Yeah, you know, the difference between porter and stout, at least in American history, we can pinpoint a 1902 text called the American Handbook of Brewing, Malting, and Auxiliary Trades.
Mm-hmm. I love how these are like, you're just like a Rolodex in your head.
They're
you think
in
of that
there.
Book, right? Because,
they're in the folds.
Ping!
I'm unfolding.
Yes.
So that one actually says that stout is stronger than porter, and that's still true today, mm-hmm. 116 years after the publishing of that book.
Whoopa! Party has started in the studio.
Good carbonation.
Opening up an early stout right now, actually, for you.
Excellent.
You might call this brown stout. It's brewed with brown malt, which doesn't really exist on the market. But I came to Greg Engert and Blue Jacket with this crazy mm-hmm. idea. Hey, we have the first ever written record of advertised beer in D.C. Let's make it. And the brewery that made it was in Navy Yard. How appropriate.
Right, because that's where Blue Jacket
yep,
is.
And we brewed three different beers and blended them together to make porter.
Sure. And I mean, that makes sense to me for Greg because he is also historically minded as well.
Yes.
And also a beer aficionado.
Yes.
You know, as one of the few like nationally recognized beer somms. And,
yeah.
You know, I could see that really appealing to him. So
yeah.
I do really get that. Let's talk a little bit about, as we moved on, when did the paler beers mm-hmm. come into play?
Great question.
There were kind of one misnomer, I guess I would say, is that there were only dark beers early on because they were smoking the malt and that's how they dried it. In fact, there were pale beers kind of throughout
right,
history.
Right, because our rosemary one is kind
yeah,
of pale,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. So that's 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
Brewers and actually maltsters, the people who are making the malt, you know, for the beer, really kind of leveled up in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. I want to say it's around 1814 they figured out how to kiln malt mm-hmm. using I believe it was a certain type of coal,
Coke,
which
yeah.
coke which okay. Which really allowed them to make their malt with even less color than normal. And so that's where you really start getting these pale ales, mm-hmm. and then we get, you know, the India pale ale. That's basically the stronger version.
But was that because of the cheapening of the product, you know, like corn syrup?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, because they were trying to make more of the product, so they wanted to make whatever they were using, they wanted to make it all cheaper?
I think it did make yeah. it cheaper, but surprisingly, the pale malt was a more expensive product than the darker kiln malt. So, like, the porter beer would be considered, like, the low-class you know, everyman beer, whereas the pale ale was like, oh yeah, this is
the
fancy
posh.
Malt, yeah, fancy malt that,
yeah.
You know, the queen's beer.
Right. So we think of IPA, India Pale Ale, as like the beer that was sent to India. It most definitely was, but actually more porter was sent to India than pale ale.
Okay.
And that's because more people of the laboring class were in India occupying it under the British occupation.
Right.
But
as
so,
that goes.
Yeah, so that's a myth that has been busted thanks to Ron Pattinson, who's come before Pete and I. He's been writing about beer history for the last three decades.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this field now where it was like three decades ago, nobody except a handful of people were paying attention to it. And now
sure.
we have incredible scholars like Teresa McCullough
sure.
in the field with us. So you really need to be on your game, and you can't be spreading any myths. You need to be myth busting and actually taking a look at it. So,
but that sounds really exciting.
Oh yeah,
you know, to sort absolutely. Of be on the forefront of rediscovering the history of, you know, something that's been around for thousands of years. I think that sounds like such fun, and you're both so lucky, and you as well, to be a part of it, because it is a movement, you know. I mean,
most definitely.
With when you talk about craft beers in DC, and I use the term craft because I feel like that sort of designates them as not Budweiser, not something else. You know, you can really see a dedication and a love for the products that they're producing and sharing it with people. And they all play really well in the sandbox, which I think is amazing. And they're all different personalities.
Right.
But, you know, there's a real love of beer. And that's not because everybody's sitting around wanting to get drunk. It's because there's a real passion for the product, what it takes to make it, and how to produce it. And I think that for people who are interested in it, the history of it really applies to that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think part of the movement you've touched upon is like the maker movement, the do-it-yourself, right? We're all charting this positive trend, be it cheese, coffee, wine,
absolutely.
Spirits. But we're also charting this trend of the, you know, it's the Me Too age. It's the people's movement. It's time to do away with the sort of whitewashing of history. Mm-hmm. And so part of that then is talking to the original makers, which were women, which were mm-hmm. people of color, especially in America. Some of the earliest brewers were people of color and women. And, you know, for the last... you
But
said,
is like, that history there? I mean, because I
no,
feel like a lot of times...
It's buried.
Like, it's buried,
it's deep.
Right?
Yeah.
I bet.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so we all know... So, like, one of the classic examples I give is like, oh, George Washington was this prolific brewer.
Yeah, well, he wasn't brewing it. Kind of,
right, exactly. Oh, Thomas Jefferson was this prolific brewer.
Again.
Well, right. And
who was
so,
really brewing it.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's kind of what Pete and I are after is to get at the people's history. And we're lucky enough to have, you know, in our homebrew club locally, a president and Sarah, who's done a fantastic job of really being inclusive, welcoming everybody in. I mean, just reflecting back to the early meetings, it was very...
Male dominated.
Pale and male. Yeah. And it looks much better, I would say, these
well,
days.
Well, I think it does speak to everybody. You know, even, I mean, listen, I can't believe I'm going to say this in front of this group. I mean, I'm not a beer drinker. I would not describe myself as a beer drinker. I like my wine. But given what I do for a living, I get to try lots of them. And I really can see the complexities and understand it. And I certainly have a palate that can discuss what's going on with them. And I'm fascinated by the history of it and where we are today, especially in the DC market, but also nationally as well. I want to back up a little bit and talk about, there's a lot of sort of, I think people think there's like beers like, I'm going to use it, Budweiser, mm-hmm. Coors, mm-hmm. sort of these big name, big brands that now people are sort of turning up their nose to. But then you get some of the, you know, brewers who are like, no, I love Pabst or, you know, they mm-hmm. PBR, you know, like they're like, give me that. So where are you guys on all that? How do you feel about that?
I think Mike and I definitely... have a lot of respect for actually, you know, the ability to make some of these macro brands. I think we have a lot of respect for the making of that beer, maybe less respect for some of the business practices like downstream, but,
right.
But there's a lot of history in those brands
right.
That is really interesting.
I think there's truly a time and a place for every beer. No question about it. And sometimes it's a very like utilitarian thing. So I should say I was born in the U.S., and that makes me take it, you know, all of my rights for granted. But my father was born in Prague in the Czech Republic, and when he first moved here with his mom, you know, she went from being an educator, a school teacher and an artist, a painter, to a maid, to a governess, a woman mm-hmm. who cleaned house and looked after children. And so I think the only beer that was really affordable to them at that point in time was something like the way that Bud is affordable to a lot of people right now.
Sure.
And so, you know, from a utilitarian standpoint, there has to be beer. Now, my father being born in Prague, he has memories of being like 10 years old, walking to the pub and just taking a glass pitcher with him.
Right.
Like, oh, you know, Steinova.
Like
and
right.
they check
Stein,
it. They
right.
check it up on his mom's tab right. and he'd bring it home for Sunday dinner. It was like, it was crazy. And so that culture, that beer drinking culture is rich with the Czechs, and we have it in America, but it's been buried. Mm-hmm. And it's been buried because when the Germans brought it pre-Prohibition, it was like, oh, here come the Huns, right? We as Americans are proper and Anglo, and we're WASPs, and like, beware that German beer-drinking culture. The Germans were very progressive. They came with this crazy idea that men and women should be allowed to drink beer at the same table at the same time.
Mm.
That children might be allowed in the beer garden, that you could drink on Sunday. These were very controversial topics in the late 1800s.
Fascinating.
Not so much anymore, but even like, you know, Fritz Hahn's and the Washington Post, his last article was about like children in breweries, right? So we're still kind of dealing with these issues.
No, actually, and I know this from Snallygaster, which the big beer festival that just happened a couple weeks ago that Neighborhood Restaurant Group puts on. You know, they had a huge children's area, which, I mean, it's a beautiful day. It's a festival. And there are things for children to do. Just because you're drinking beer, because you're drinking beer doesn't mean you can't include your children.
Absolutely,
I mean, we've taken my children to vineyards, you know, in California or Italy or whatever. I mean, why shouldn't they be...
Yeah.
Why shouldn't they be not only allowed, but educated on
most
the process and on what it is?
Most definitely.
Right? Isn't that how you develop appreciation
early
on?
You have to be taught it from a young age.
Right?
Yeah.
That's very interesting. Okay, so the Germans come. Are they the people really behind the big beers early on?
Yep. I mean, it starts with the English and porter. Porter. So that's the first style that travels the world. Now the biggest style brewed the world over is Pilsner. But if you try Pilsner in the majority of the world, it's not as tasty as some of the Pilsners brewed in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia.
Okay.
So when you go with mass production and large scale, sometimes quality can taper off, sometimes not. But the Germans definitely bring the industrial scale with them. So just to give you some numbers, like in 1916, D.C. brewed over 122,000 barrels of beer.
Okay.
In 2016, the city brewed 33,000 barrels of beer.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like a 90,000 less.
But well, what happened with Prohibition though? Because didn't that had to decimate everything, right? We had to start from scratch.
Yeah.
I mean, I know there were people doing it anyway, but
especially at the on the homebrew level,
right? In the homebrew. Yeah. I mean, I assume that's where everybody was doing it. But how did that grossly affected?
Yeah, absolutely.
The beer making in DC and the spirits. I mean, everything that was going on here.
Yep.
And it's you know, and actually Prohibition is actually even tied into sort of World War I. So all of a sudden we're at war with Germany. And so these German immigrants, we just kind of consider them as part of the enemy.
Sure.
As well as their beer drinking
And they were
culture.
Drinking beer.
Right. So we have to outlaw that. And
right.
So that's, you know, so even after Prohibition is over, there's still kind of a lingering discrimination against these German brewers in a lot of parts of the country.
Yeah.
And so,
each wave of immigrants, you know, the Italians, there was a huge, you know, the Chinese, like each wave, the Jews, like every sort of wave of immigrants has had their own racism towards them, no different than what's going
on
today. You know,
Absolutely.
There's always xenophobia. It always happens.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see in history what some of the causes were and what some of the effects were with it.
Yeah, most definitely. So, obviously, in the news just recently was this terrible tragedy in Pittsburgh. Talk about anti-Semitism and xenophobia being the root cause. You know, so my grandfather was Jewish, lived in Prague. My grandmother's Catholic. They married not in a church, not in a synagogue, in the town hall. You know, like a JOP kind of thing nowadays. But the crazy thing is that there were Jews in German beer production in the 1830s. Something like 90% of the hops market in Bamberg, Germany was run by Jews, right? And that, if you believe...
Maybe that was part, as a Jew, I'm going to say,
stereotypically,
that could have been part of the problem.
Right, but if you believe conspiracy, then yes. If not, you're like, oh, there was actually a great flourishing of multiculturalism and multi-religions agreeing and getting along prior to the Holocaust or something terrible like that.
Right.
So, yeah, I think most definitely there is a fear. You know, 1918, we think about, so national prohibition comes in 1920. D.C., it comes early in 1917. This is right when women get the vote.
Right.
But then alcohol is banned. And actually, I would argue, and I think most scholars would, that prohibition led to a rise in spirits, bathtub gin.
Yes.
Because if you're going to load the wagon, you want to pack the car full of as much
booze
you want
as
to sell
possible.
As right.
And as strong as possible.
And as strong as possible.
Right.
So a keg of whiskey might fetch $50 and a keg of beer might be $5.
Sure.
Right? So,
I mean, that makes sense. Yeah. And it could take less time to make or more time to make
depending on
the quality, right? okay, so let's fast forward to after World War II. and sort of this other wave that we're talking about and where we are today. And I want to bring the home brewers back in.
Yeah.
And I want to leave Sarah alone over there because we're totally geeking out over here historically. But, you know, you brought in all these beers today. There is this explosion, I feel like, in D.C. And I know it's happening in other markets as well. But I feel that D.C. is really special in the kind of beers that are being made and the way that they're rolling them out.
Definitely. Most definitely. Sarah, do you want to talk about some of your special beers? Or
Yeah, I would love that. And, like, do you collaborate? Do you have beer makers come in and talk to your group? And then do they do collaborations? Because I know there's a lot of collabs going on, but I was curious how they work with you at all.
Sure. We have done some collaborations with our club and breweries. So for our 10th anniversary, we actually worked with Right Proper, which is where we held our 10th anniversary party. And we had some people come in and brew a beer with Nathan there. So we did do that. A lot of our, we have a number of members who have kind of done their own collaborations, like clearly Pete and Mike have done collaborations through Lost Lagers with different breweries. And we have some other members who either have collaborated with breweries or gone out and started their own breweries as well. So we have some people who are still in the club, homebrew sometimes, but also
are part of the world.
Yeah, on the professional scale
I'll give
now.
A plug to Jeannie Burns. Jeannie is our VP, our vice president, and she also has just recently started brewing at the Lake Ann Brew House, which also has some female ownership. Do you want to talk about the Pink Boots beer or the Solace, the beer you brewed at Solace?
Oh, yeah. So so the Pink Boots Society is a group that started, I think it was in 2007, and it was basically started by a woman who had traveled to a lot of breweries and saw the lack of women in them. And so she started this group to encourage women to get into the beer industry. So now basically anyone who works in the industry, even in part, can be part of, can join the Pink Boots Society. I'm part of the local chapter because I work in a tap room a little bit here. So we brewed a beer in, I guess that was March, for our group as part of International Women's Collaboration Brew Day.
Okay.
And
what is the date of that?
It's early March, so I want to say March 8th, but I don't know if it's always on the 8th or if that varies slightly.
Day. Right.
But yeah, so we did a beer and we brewed at Solace, where the head brewer is also a woman. And
Bridget Turner, shout out to Bridget.
Yeah, Bridget's great. And so we got together there, did a brew day there, and then brought kegs of that into a bunch of the participating breweries and bars and sold it for charity, basically.
That's amazing. So. Now, let me ask you a question, and I would like all of you to sort of pipe in on this. I mean, do you, now that there is more women in the brewing world, are more women in the brewing world, is there a layer of misogyny? Do people still think, oh, women can't brew beer? Is that still prevalent? Was it prevalent? You know, what do you think are stereotypes dying? What's happening?
Yeah. Yes, there is most definitely misogyny, unfortunately. But I think what's good is that a lot of the old stereotypes and tropes are beginning to fade, right? Like, there's a documentarian out of California and her doc is called All Beer is Girl Beer.
Cute.
And it's like, yeah, of course. Like,
duh, like girls drink beer, right?
Right. Like, the IPA is not for men. And, I love fruited beer. I love strawberry Hefeweizen.
Okay, and can I be honest with you? No, thank you.
Right.
Yeah. I don't want
right.
that beer.
Exactly.
Like, everybody's like, because when I tell people I'm not a beer drinker, they think it's because it's bitter. So they give me something sweet, like one of the framboise, right?
Right.
Yeah. And I'm always like...
Yeah. Right,
it's just
fruited
like
beer.
Sugar.
It's the
go-to. I don't want that. Yeah, no,
it's
thank
like
you.
Think about it. Ask this person what they would like, and then figure out a rec. And I think that's an old trope we've been fed, right? Like, oh, the raspberry wit is a girl's beer. It's
sure,
like, get out of here with
right,
that.
It's
nonsense.
Like a Cosmo being only for women.
Exactly.
I'm totally with you.
Exactly. No, it's not the case.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and there are just increasingly a lot more women who are going into it. So partly, you know, you're talking about this craft beer explosion, that means there's all of a sudden thousands more brewing jobs and jobs in the beer industry.
Also, very true. That's a very good point.
And so it's no longer just, you know, you think of the brewers at like Budweiser or Miller. Mm-hmm. These are like unionized jobs that are really much more factory type work, where you just, you know, you have your shift and you go and you do whatever thing you're trained for.
Like Laverne and Shirley.
Right. And, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I know I'm dating myself a little bit, but like that's what I see in my head. Right?
The conveyor belt going
yes, exactly.
by. And like, oh my God, I can't drink this beer fast enough. but, you know, and all these craft breweries, like there's a little bit more, I think, open-mindedness to breaking traditions. And so I think it does really allow women to get their foot in the door a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. There's still a ton of misogyny in the brewing industry, unfortunately. And, you know,
well, we got a wave here. We have a little bit of a wave that can start changing that.
Well, I think there is some, definitely. But I feel like it's not like constant or all the time. Like, I don't run into it every time I'm at a brewery or every, and I think especially craft breweries, like you're saying, are much more like cognizant of that, and they understand that their audience is not
just
men.
They also want to make money, right?
Right.
So if people are visiting their brewery, offending somebody by assuming that they don't know anything about their product, I mean, if somebody did that to me, I would be like, and yeah, dude, I know that, but, and I'm out. It would be an offense to me.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I would have a real problem with it. So, well, that's good to hear. Okay. I want to talk about the Hill Center because you guys do classes there, and you have one coming up. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So we, about once a quarter or so, we'll teach a class at the Hill Center, which is a historic community center on Capitol Hill, right on Pennsylvania.
It's a really cool space.
The old Naval Hospital there.
Yeah, it's called the Hill Center at the old Naval Hospital because
it was the Naval Hospital.
It was the Naval Hospital during the Civil War, and it was the first. It's historic in its own right because people like Walt Whitman and Frederick Douglass have traipsed through and around it. Mm-hmm. They treated Benjamin Drummond, who was the first African American Navy, I guess, midshipman. So it's a historic landmark in its own right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so it's kind of, you know, it's winter.
And
it's
by the way, Little Pearl is right next door.
Right. And Little Pearl.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
So after your class, know where you're going to eat.
That's right.
Right. Right. Yeah. Great wine there and great food. But, you know, it's kind of fall right now, getting closer to winter. So it's a good time to make porter. You know, it's, you know, that dark beer season, something to warm you up. And so we're going to be kind of talking about porters throughout history. And so... porters, you know, from the colonial era, when it's more of like a British beer, and kind of talk about then, you know, all these Germans come over to the United States and everybody's drinking porter. So they try and figure out, okay, well, we have to sell porter, but we only know how to make lager. So all of a sudden, porter is now a lager instead of an ale.
Interesting.
And you know, they kind of revolutionized a couple techniques. And so we'll kind of talk about how they changed this style since they were the brewers in the late 19th century.
And then do you offer a variety of beers for people to taste so they have a sort of a walkthrough of what you're doing?
Yeah, so we're going to kind of walk through, obviously, the history, as I mentioned, and then with each sort of era, we'll kind of have a beer that we'll taste and kind of understand these different types of porters and different eras of porter. Yeah. And kind of during the whole class, we're actually going to be brewing a historic porter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we'll give everybody kind of the recipe for how to brew one of these historic porters. If you've been a home brewer forever, or you're just trying to learn how to home brew, you can kind of take some knowledge from the class. And and so hopefully you'll learn some about home brewing, learn some about history, and learn some, taste some good beer.
Right. That's what it sounds like. And you guys do this once a quarter?
Yeah, about every couple months. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
And then I understand you're a beer judge.
Correct. Yeah.
Like a certified?
And so are you, Sarah, too.
So,
yeah.
Okay. How does one get certification?
They're both in the beer judges certificate program.
Okay. Because I have to be honest, I don't want to like make you angry, but I get asked to judge beer all the time. And I'm always like,
I mean, I have a palate, so I get that, but
I'm not a beer, like I said, I'm not a classic beer drinker. So what did it take to get your certification? I'm very curious.
It's a lot of studying.
Yeah, because, I mean, the logistics are like you take a test, basically, but there's like an online exam, and if you score high enough on that, you can take a tasting exam where it's six beers over a couple hours.
So is it similar to a SOM? You know, do you have to like... know the hops, know the brewmaker? Like how complex do you need to be when you're describing the beer?
I'd say for this, it's a little less intense than a Somm. There is like the Cicerone beer levels, and I think those are a little closer related to the Somm probably. For this, it's focused around homebrew, actually. So the focus is on these categories that the Homebrewers Association has deemed the categories of beer. So you're basically judging each beer as if you would in a homebrew competition. So you have a score sheet you have to fill out for each one and describe the aroma, the flavor, the appearance, the mouthfeel, and your overall, and whether that beer is a good example of that style.
Okay. And I guess my question is, especially when it comes to beer, is it's one of the questions I always have for Somms when it comes to wine. I mean, how do you judge it? Because we all have personal tastes, and our taste buds are all different, even if you're a super taster. How do you take your opinion out to judge the beer?
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Very difficult, very difficult. But it is set up to try to achieve that goal. So, you know, you're trying to judge it based on, you know, meeting certain characteristics. So is this pale ale, does it have, you know, the right amount of hop characteristic? Is it too hoppy, not hoppy enough?
Right.
So there's sort of more objective things that the beer is trying to achieve, as opposed to, do I like this pale ale? So it's pretty impossible to take your own opinion out of things, but when you're judging, that's what you're supposed to do. It's not about you. Like, okay, does this beer, you know, does it have the right? Does this Hefeweizen have like the banana character? Okay, that's good. That means it's two style.
Right.
So you're trying to determine whether a beer is two style, not whether it's a good or a bad beer.
Interesting. Okay. So are you guys judging lots of beer events? Like, do you get asked?
DC Homebrewers has a competition once a year in which, you know, we basically accept entries from around the country. We've even gotten international entries where people will send their beer in to be judged by local, you know, DC homebrewers, judges, and other judges from around the area.
Right, that is a gauntlet thrown, everybody. Oh my God, send your beer.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it.
It's kind of a weird occupation where people will send their beer to you and you just get to drink beer, and they actually pay you for that privilege. They pay a little entry fee.
They pay the club
DC
or whoever's organizing
not the judge.
As a judge, you don't really
Let's
get paid.
Let's be clear.
You
no
do get
payola.
Beer.
Wait a second. Who's getting paid here and who isn't? All right. Well, I can't believe it. We're out of time. And I feel like there's still, like, I feel like we only got a scratch in the history of beer and barely talked about DC and what's happening next, like the next wave. Where do we go from here? But I'd love to have you all back in, obviously, sometime in the future. Sarah, tell everybody how they can reach you and join you and get in on your events.
Yeah, so our website is dchomebrewers.com.
Okay, super easy.
We're also on Facebook, like /dchomebrewers.
Are you on Instagram?
Yes. Okay. Instagram is dchomebrewclub.
Okay.
And on Twitter, we're dchomebrewers as well.
Excellent. Okay.
And we do have, I just want to mention, on Saturday the 3rd, November 3rd, we have a Learn to Homebrew brewing demo at Atlas Brew Works in DC. So we're going to just be brewing a beer so anyone who wants to see the process can stop by, or if you already brew, you can just come drink with us.
Excellent. Okay, I love that. And gentlemen, tell people where they can find you and how they can work with you, and, you know, learn more about beer through you and Lost Lagers.
So yeah, we're Lost Lagers on all of the social medias. At Lost Lagers on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, lostlagers.com. You can join. We have a mailing list that we don't spam you too much.
Okay.
So definitely follow us on any of those.
Yeah. Follow us on those, join the mailing list, and to get tickets to our class at the Hill Center on November 18th, you can just go to hillcenterdc.org. So one word, hillcenterdc.org. And our class is Historic Homebrewing Class, Porter from George Washington to Near Extinction.
And that's November 18th, 11 to 2 p.m.
Excellent. I just have to say the whole studio right now smells like rosemary. So good. And I'm going
to
end the
Eliza
show.
Smith.
Yes,
cheers
exactly.
To Eliza Smith.
Cheers to Eliza.
Yeah.
Cheers to all of you for coming in today. And I do want to end on a brewery note, because Blue Jacket is actually hosting David and I as Foodie and the Beast. It is the Foodie and the Beast 10-year anniversary party. It is November 11th, which is a Sunday. Sweet. It's from 11 to 2. It's a two-hour live show. Of Ooh. Course, the guy Greg Angert and the team at Blue Jacket are going to be doing fabulous beers. They're going to have some $5 specials. Marcel, the chef, who is lovely, Ooh, yeah. and I She's adore her, and she's such a talent. She does amazing food to go with all the beers. She is going to be doing some brunch specials. So you're going to be eating, you're going to be drinking, and we are going to have a literal parade of chefs and spirit makers and beer makers and people from the DC community and abroad coming in. Just sort of, the whole show will be sort of themed under then and now. 10 years ago, where were you? Nice. And where are you today? So awesome. We're really excited. It is a free event. Please come and join us. Again, I want to thank all the people joining me in studio today. It was a delicious show, and I hope you have a delicious week.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.